that we are recording again. Yeah, I didn't get the names of your parents. That's kind of a good piece of information to have.
Well, you can do that by email even, but Muriel.
Muriel.
Thomas Clark. C-L-A-R-K-E. Thomas was her Welsh maiden name. And Lee Keckley Clark.
Keckley?
K-E-C-K-L-E-Y. And his grandfather and great-grandfather fought in the Civil War, for the Union Army in the Civil War.
Okay. Oh, boy.
That's how they came to Homestead in Nebraska.
Ah, I see. Yeah, it's interesting how those historical events affect our lives in a large way. And so they homesteaded in Nebraska. They were from second generation?
No,
first generation.
Somebody was in the country in 1620.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right.
So, you know, I think it was but every generation seemed to move west.
Uh-huh.
And so the pair who joined the Union Army were living in Indiana at the time.
Ah, okay. Indiana was one of those states that was kind of neither here nor there, was it, with regard to the
It was technically Union.
Yeah. But it was wasn't there was.
But that's like Maryland. Maryland was technically Confederate, but the population really had two views.
Yeah. Well, Missouri was the same.
Oh yeah.
No, I think all those border states were kind of in a bit of a bind.
Yeah.
The Missouri Historical Society is running a big thing about the Civil War in Missouri now, 150th anniversary, pointing out how the two different sides semi-coexisted and shot at each other and squirted at each other and caused all kinds of problems for each other.
Yeah.
And so you're finally have been kicked into the basement because your department head doesn't think much of chemistry in general.
Less of chemistry, yeah.
And mass spectrometry was even less to be thought of.
Well, we were beginning to be useful though, so maybe it could be called biochemistry. And as we went to the basement, we got this NSF Regional Instrumentation Award, and that was saw us in good stead for.
Did that have the same kind of requirements that the NIH type award has, where you have to provide service, run samples for other
and do core
academic
research.
And do core research and publish papers and et cetera, et cetera. So the same general.
Similar. I'm sure that the folks from NIH would tell you us what the differences are, but It provided for major equipment, which we probably wouldn't have gotten otherwise.
Now, this equipment didn't have GC with it, the new
MS-50 did not.
Okay.
And one time, just as we paid Don Hagee to put an INCOS unit on our GCMS, we paid Marvin Vestal to come and interface thermospray to the MS-50. And that actually didn't work out too well.
Uh-huh.
I think it was a little early in his thermophase inventions. So
it seems like Marvin appears in many places.
Yeah, he's a traveling instrumentalist.
Yes, definitely. So then you stuck with what, CI, chemical ionization, and EI?
Had FAB.
FAB. Yes.
It came with FD, but after we added a year or something, Fast Atom Bombardment, the company was selling that, and they delivered us the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And we did some really interesting things with it. One of the papers, you asked me, your outline says, what are your favorite papers? And one of them was a paper in JAX in 1981 where we published spectra of nucleotides that were alkylated with this anti-cancer drug that we're interested in.
Oh, okay.
It's a good alkylating agent, and so.
So that was.
They were definitely not volatile, Having phosphates on the nucleotides and phosphates on the cancer.
Yes, well, FAB, I think, made really a serious impact at that time, because it really worked for all those compounds and nothing else worked for.
Yeah, and it was much more reliable than plasma desorption or field desorption. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't have this. When electrospray came along, electrospray had more sensitivity. It was implemented with more sensitivity.
Did you get into any negative ion work?
We probably have published some negative ion papers, but somehow the laws of physics seem to be violated, that these instruments don't transmit negative ions as well as they do positive ions.
In theory, it shouldn't be that big of a difference, right?
Yeah,
I mean, ion is charged, but you got to reverse everything, and it never does seem to work as well as the other way around. So you really probably hopped onto Fab pretty quickly, I guess.
Yes, mm-hmm. And had this was the first structure paper, a structure elucidation published with Fab. This
mm-hmm.
is 1991, Jack's paper.
81,
thank you.
81. Yeah. Okay. So that was... thermal desorption source and probe MS-50, middle molecule mass spec review, simultaneous immobilization of cytochrome P450, identification of 3-alkylated nucleotide. That's the one, right? The 3-alkylated nucleotide adduction reaction.
Yeah, but I don't know if it had all those other... Were you just reading through a bunch of titles?
I'm looking at titles, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Whatever's in Jack's, the first author was probably VU.
VU, yeah. Vanessa, mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was...
That was a goodie.
That was a goodie from the viewpoint that it got a lot of attention.
It's well-referenced. It's not one of my highest reference papers, but it got a lot of attention from the Fab community.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are a lot of people interested in alkylated nucleotides,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of people interested in this cancer drug, so it had attention from a variety of communities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that was probably one of the first things you did with Fab.
Yeah.
Now, there's all this business with what liquid sims and this kind of squirting match between the people who said that it already existed well before the organic chemists came along and all that good stuff.
I'm willing to agree with that.
Okay. I guess Barbara and that group were the first ones to actually use it, to show that you could use it for organic chemistry.
You know, he published a paper in Rapid Communications, mm-hmm. was it? And there's a paper right beside it from a physical chemist at the same chemistry department, doing the same thing with, only calling it Sims, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it sounded to me like they might even have worked together to evolve the idea, but then they fell out and published it separately.
That's interesting.
And the physical chemist is still, Mike Barber died, and the physical chemist is still active in research. He does a lot of imaging studies with Sims. I can get you his name if you'd like.
Well, I would kind of explore that idea that you, mm-hmm. it would be interesting from a historical viewpoint.
Well, the two papers are there. I didn't
know
the other guy at all.
I can go to that literature because I can access that and find mm-hmm. find the papers. But I remember there's a certain amount of you guys have reinvented the wheel thing, you know.
But those guys... commercialized it,
yeah.
You know, and thus you didn't have to be a physical chemist to have access to it. You know.
And it seemed to work so simply.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, of course, mm-hmm. there was all this business of trying to develop different matrices. I mean, glycerol was probably, everybody just picked up on that, I imagine, and used that pretty much. But
you know the BG, now we are talking about two English companies that also brought it out almost simultaneously, commercialized it almost simultaneously. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe both companies didn't want to give away the glycerol secret. You know, here we have our magic fluid, mm-hmm. we'll put your sample in and it'll work. And so the first time the technician in my lab at Hopkins, a man named Gordon Hansen, mm-hmm. looked at the spectrum, he said, oh, that's glycerol. So that was a secret that was hard to keep.
If you knew a little bit about mass spec, and then it was very easy to sort it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, for instance, I think mass calibration could be a little bit challenging sometimes with Fab, as I recall. Well, actually, no, we put the salsa on there, and that worked pretty well. Depending on the mass range, if you were pushing things mass.
Yeah, it's true that you had to do a different calibration.
How high in mass read did you take with your Fab things? Did you really get up into this higher mass?
Well, we were very proud of our insulin spectrum.
Oh, wow, okay.
And I'm trying to think if we didn't do some pro-insulin, which is 9. But we wanted it with unit resolution, so the insulin spectrum is resolved.
Oh, wow.
And the heavier, the pro-insulin is a blob.
Mm-hmm. So that was, that would have been in 19...
The early 80s.
Early 80s? Wow, okay.
I once gave a talk and had a collection of everybody's insulin spectra. And, Michael Barber published one, we published one, Howard Morris published one. The best one probably was from an instrument in Japan. They called it the Grand Mass Spectrometer. It had a very large radius of curvature.
It was a magnetic sector, big sector guy.
Yeah, it took probably a half a cup of sample, but it didn't resolve. It did give good, very good resolution.
Neat. Interesting. Yes, well, that's something that does come in handy to have that. But that was pretty impressive to have unit mass resolution.
Yeah, thought so.
Yeah, at that point in time that was with the MS-50.
Yes.
Now, how was getting the machine? They have these high resolving power specifications. Were they attainable, or were they just like?
Yeah, that was a really well-made instrument. I mean. It met specs with no problem. It did take some weeks to get it set up and pumped down and the ion trajectory established, but there weren't any setbacks, and it did meet specs.
So once it was installed and specced up, then that was it stayed there.
In contrast to the 4-day installation of our 4-sector JEOL system, 10 years later, well, more than that, 15 years later, but 10 years later,
Well, that's an important, the thing that's kind of strange about that instrument is that the 50 is, the ion source physical location has to be kind of fixed rather carefully. That's part of the optics. The VG machine, they had this kind of self-referencing thing, the source was on a spring, and when you put it in, it kind of got referenced.
Positioned itself.
But the 50, it was on the flange, hard on the flange, so that flange had to be very...
Is that why I had so much old gold flange in my...
Yeah.
My desk.
Yeah. That's pretty valuable gold.
Yes. I recently traded my gold flange in for a computer for the lab.
Oh, well, hey, this is a good time to do it. Yes, that's an interesting concept. So, you end up having to do the routine baking and all that kind of good stuff that comes with the instrument in terms of keeping it clean for resolving power purposes.
We treated it as it was supposed to be treated. But at that point, with the NSF funding, I was running it less. It was less close to it. And so this is like the first instrument I didn't have my hands on very much.
Okay.
So a guy named Gordon Hansen and a guy named David Heller were the folks who were closest to the instrument.
Okay. And so they kept it up to snuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so you did a lot of probe samples.
Yeah.
Did you?
Yes. But the exciting biological polymers, that we'd never been able to do before.
Yeah, So the GC, you never was put in a GCMS mode or modified?
It didn't even come with a GC.
Yeah.
But the LC that we tried to work out with Marvin, the thermospray just wasn't working.
Yeah.
We didn't go ahead with that. And so instead we got a second instrument, an interfaced LCMS.
Yeah, so that was...
With thermospray.
That would have been a pretty exciting time to be having an instrument that could do those kind of things with a direct probe and biological samples, which were almost impossible to do.
Well, and I guess the theme for our NSF facility was pushing the mass range.
Nah.
So that instrument allowed us to deliver.
Yes, yeah.
One of the papers that you asked me about, what papers I liked, there's a paper in analytical chemistry in 1983, where we envisioned the kind of isotope clusters that we might get with proteins that weigh 100,000 or 10,000.
Uh-huh.
So we really were laying the groundwork for working with heavier samples.
So this was the whole business with the way, this would be a theoretical description of how the isotopic pattern would shift as you got into higher masses, and the carbon-13 peak would start to take off
the L-carbon-12 anymore. And then we did a couple other papers that worried about how the world would change at high mass, even though we didn't have electrospray yet. One of them was the speed of fragmentation. You know, we managed to find experimental conditions with actually using plasma desorption, time of flight, as well as the MS-50, to show that the heavier molecules decomposed more slowly.
Because there's more degrees of freedom to distribute energy.
I don't know if that surprises anybody now, but it was a very nice experimental, you know, got a three-point curve. And, and that one was analytical chemistry, 1987.
So did you do that work with Jurgi on the, I see Al's name here on isotopic distribution and mass spectra of large molecules?
He wrote a little program that allowed us to generate those.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he was a very good postdoc for other reasons, too.
So he was a postdoc at that time in your
this
shop?
This is Jim, not Al.
Jim.
Al's brother Jim.
I see. Okay, well, I didn't even know about brother Jim. All I know about is Al. No, this is good to know.
Brother Jim works for Merck Frost in Canada.
Uh-huh.
He's probably not doing mass spectrometry, but he's probably doing some kind of analytical, in charge of some analytical
unit. I see. Okay.
And he's even more affable than Al.
Okay. So it was 1987 that the other work was done with plasma desorption, you say? Or?
Well, it was done with several ionization techniques, but the first name on that one could be Demeroff.
Yeah.
1987, analytical chemistry.
High mass fragmentation is a function of time.
So those were papers that, even though we weren't getting much above 10,000, let's say, those papers were laying the intellectual foundation.
Mm.
We also published on not necessarily one of my favorite papers, but published the idea of you doing a survey scan to find out where the large mass range, the Bulliger ion, it was, and then could go back and elaborate on that. And that's a standard used in high mass, in top-down
protein analysis. Yeah.
So we were thinking hard about it and encouraging the rest of the community to think hard about it.
So these ended up being papers as well at the ASMS meetings? And
oh, I'm sure. Everything. Yes, absolutely. I don't have those references, but we know how to get them.
So it's a very exciting time, being able to do things. I guess you had a lot of other people in the community doing as well. Each had kind of carved out a little bit of a...
There was a lot of competition, too.
There was?
Sure. Burlingame had very similar equipment.
Uh-huh.
And then a guy at Illinois, Ken Reinhardt.
Yeah, Reinhardt.
Probably was more in the natural products business, but he'd like to show off his fab source. And so that was fun,
But, I mean, were you all doing fab, but you were not competing in the part of biochemicals that you were looking at, were you?
I'd say, I don't know about competing, but several of us were addressing proteins.
Ah, okay.
Howard Morris was addressing proteins in England. So there were, that makes it go faster if there's more than one contributing.
Well, that's the thing I was kind of curious about McCloskey, is he was kind of out there in the nucleoside world pretty much by himself.
I think that's my opinion, yeah.
Yeah.
And doing work that seemed very esoteric at the time with RNA methylation. Mm-hmm. Of course, then when people figured out that RNA was folded and that a lot of the modifications directed and stabilized the folding, then Jim was suddenly very important.
Well, I mean, they were funding it, and he told me that they actually had to, you know, looked at his work and said, well, I got to move you from this pot to another pot, but they didn't say, well, in other words, it wasn't, we can't fund you, but here's a place that can.
That's
rather,
right.
Rather than saying, we can't fund you and go away. So obviously the work was
somebody
important.
Somebody thought it was important,
that
right.
They were, that they uh-huh. saw to it that he got his research shifted. In the, but so then, when did you, I mean, proteomics seems to be one of the big buzzwords of the modern age. Which is 2012, and I'm curious when you started to get into the protein stuff. I mean,
really not until I moved to UMBC. I mean, we were weighing, interested in weighing proteins, but in terms of sequencing and doing kind of looking at post-translational modifications.
So the protein weight did what for you?
Well, it proved that, that we could, for one thing. We looked at some insulins from different species, and I guess if we could see a different mass, we could, that might, used in conjunction with classical sequencing, tell us what the differences were between species. So we weren't really, so we were really doing more emphasis on methods development in Hawkins, on how to work with a large ion rather than applying it.
There's this whole issue with larger ions making less of a signal. When they get to the detector, is that, was that
sure? So we do post acceleration.
So once they get there, you give them a little kick, extra kick.
And in fact, in the probably the reason that Tanaka got the Nobel Prize was because he designed his instrument to analyze heavy ions, and although he used a funny matrix, some kind of powdered metal. He had post-acceleration, he had a longer flight tube, and whatever was needed to characterize, to confirm that he had desorbed as heavy as proteins and protein clusters. And when Helen Kapp saw the, or heard about the Tanaka results, he went home and put in post-acceleration. And I think this is actually in a discussed by Michael Karas in an article in Analytical Chemistry just before the 2002 Nobel Prize was announced.
So that was a definite requirement that you, ran up against pretty much immediately, is so you can get the mass spectrometer to separate these things and get them out there, but without...
Still have to detect them,
still have a detector issue, and it has to be souped up in order to handle these larger compounds. That was an important development, and did it come out of the instrumental manufacturer types?
Well, you know, Tanaka's at Shimadzu.
Yeah.
I don't know if he was the only one who did it, and probably somebody would tell me that the Atomic Energy Commission did it during the Second World Wars. I mean, nothing seems to be ever be totally
new. Somebody got there sooner.
But they weren't using it to analyze whole proteins.
Right.
Yeah.
So you moved into the protein business, you say, when you moved to...
my next campus, right.
Next campus.
I got to tell you, if I may... two more things about Hopkins. We're going back a little bit.
Yeah, that's fine.
The papers of which I'm most proud there, or I guess I've got two on the list here. We've just talked about the high mass work, but two others. I told you we were developing methods to synthesize and characterize these glucuronide conjugates of drugs, and there was a problem that the FDA was having with a natural product that was proposed to be an anti-cancer agent, and it was called Laetrile, and it was uncertain what it actually was, and it was also uncertain whether it actually had any effect on the drug, on the disease. But in any case, because we could make glucuronides, they gave us some of the drug part, and we conjugated it to glucuronic acids. And then the FDA extracted the peach pits or apricot pits that were used to produce the commercial product in Mexico, and we compared. This would probably be both 21-110 work and GCMS work, and I think we did some high resolution measurements on it, and compared the spectra of the commercial product, the patented product, and the commercial product and what had been patented, what the glucuronide that we made, and they weren't the same thing. So we helped the FDA and the courts define what the commercial substance was. And it was taken off the market then. Yeah. I think they also were able to show that it had no effect on cancer.
So the commercial product was an attempt to synthesize what was happening with this natural product.
The commercial product was probably a fake.
Yeah,
out and out a fake.
It's just that wow.
And that was published in Science in 1977.
Oh wow!
So okay. It definitely goes into the Hawkins folder.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's my only paper in Science.
Well, one doesn't get there that easily. But
I don't try very often. Then the other one I wanted to mention to you from Hopkins, 1977, I don't even know whose name is first. There were so many names on that paper. But so all of this, the other thing that I wanted to mention from the Hopkins Times was that all of this work with the real cancer drug, cyclophosphamide, was published in several papers. Some of them had Ian Jarden's name on them. And the one that I like the best is the one that's called A Human Metabolite of Cyclophosphamide, and that was in Cancer Research in 1973.
Oh, wow. So that's going back a ways.
Well, that was done with that GCMS that we talked about, you know, and permethylation and all that stuff. Horrible.
Biologically active metabolite of cyclophosphamide.
Yeah, 1973.
Yeah, 1973 with Coleman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He was the oncologist.
Yeah, okay. That was in cancer
the
research.
The cancer chemist, yeah. And then you got the Science one in 77.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that brings me, those are the comments I wanted to make.
So these are all related to cancer research, right? The a lot of the important ones at Hopkins.
The last two I mentioned were, but the other set that were related to how to analyze how to analyze proteins, basically. Okay. So
what brought you to the end of your tenure at
Hopkins?
Oh, okay. You were in the tenure track.
I got tenure in 84.
Okay,
maybe?
So you ended up being tenured.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've told you already that Hopkins is very good with their money. So when I got the big grant from NIH, it helped to get tenure. And in 88, I moved to a University of Maryland campus, but not this campus, one called Baltimore County.
Okay.
It's halfway between here and Baltimore. And I guess I had decided that I wanted to be more active in teaching.
Oh, okay.
That I could be in the medical school. And I also felt that I was never going to get a chance to try being a chair of a department, because the chairs in that medical school are for life.
Ah.
and I noticed in my department they tended to be MDs, and so
surprise.
So I moved to try my wings in another pond, if I could mix my metaphors.
Mm-hmm.
And that was and had a very interesting time there. UMBC was a campus founded in the 60s when there was this glut of college students and a lot of state systems built additional campuses.
Mm-hmm.
And it had the permission to grant PhDs, but it hadn't built much of a research program. Had a very good president at that time named Michael Hooker, who went on to be the chancellor of the University of Massachusetts system, and also eventually the I'm not sure about these if it's president or chancellor, but at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And he hired a assistant provost. He hired someone into the administration whose job it was to increase the enrollment of African American students in that
mm-hmm.
campus. And that man's name is Freeman Hrabowski. And Freeman Hrabowski has been the president of that campus now for nearly 20 years. He succeeded Hooker when Hooker left.
So that's R something, or?
Hrabowski, as he said, the plantation owner was Polish. But you understand Freeman.
His first name.
And Freeman was a very educated person. I think he probably had a bachelor's in math and a PhD in education.
Oh, okay.
And he's still there. They're very fortunate to have had his hand, one hand and a good hand on the helm for a long time. It was fun working with Freeman. He started a really successful program for educating high-achieving African men. And he met high-achieving in science and math, mm-hmm. engineering. And I got to be in the founding faculty of that program. And then when he started getting federal money, they told him he had to limit it. He couldn't exclude women. And then he decided he couldn't have it just black. But, so anyway, it's still a very good program, and it still has that focus. So at that campus, I went there as chair of the department. And
that was your beginning position at the campus?
Yeah. Okay. And then I was an interim dean of the graduate school for, 18 months, and that let me sit in on the president's weekly president's council meeting, so I learned a lot about running universities then. And also did some really interesting research, which I want to tell you about, but I'm just looking to see. So anyway, Talalay was my last mentor. I don't count these other guys and gals as mentors.
Well, you're pretty well, on your own by that
time.
Yeah,
I guess that's correct. And so the papers I would mention there are, I seem to be slipping into science pretty fast here, we had a four sector. We had the JUL four sector.
So
I was moving, I applied to NSF, back to NSF for, we had the NSF Regional Instrumentation Center at Hopkins.
Okay.
Which Bob wanted to inherit or take, not inherit, but he wanted to take over completely. And I wanted, of course, to have something, a similar sized operation at UMBC, so I applied to NSF for such a support like that at the new place, and they gave it to us, and we bought a four sector instrument. And when I went there, I had the biggest grant on campus.
Probably the biggest piece of equipment.
Big fog in a little pod, yeah. So, but the four sector is a fabulous instrument. It really was.
This was a JUL machine.
The JUL four sector was a fabulous instrument. I don't know that the VG ever worked very well. But
yeah. I don't know what
to do. your experience now. Yeah. So I won an award from the International Mass Spectrometry Society, shared it with Kathy Costello and Peter Ripsdorf from Denmark.
Mm-hmm.
And so we all were supposed to give 10-minute histories of our lives, and we all three ended with a picture of a four-sector J. Oh, that was astonishing. That was such a big... It was thrilling to have that instrument. Now, nobody uses sectors very much anymore.
Yeah.
No, it was a fab instrument, but we got it upgraded to electrospray, blah, blah, blah.
So what? How much did that kind of equipment cost?
It was $1 million.
Million?
In that day.
Okay.
Yeah. The box arrived, and four Japanese engineers got out and put it together in 4 days. So,
did they fly that in from Japan?
I think it came by ship.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just so well engineered that that there was no problem with alignment.
Four sectors, you got to have some problems.
Well, yeah, but they were pumping down and seeing anchor in 4 days.
Wow!
And they may have tuned it after that, but they were out of the lab in a week. So so we used it and loved it, and several of the names you want me to comment on sometime were people who use that instrument to full advantage. So one of the best things we did there was to measure the proton affinity of arginine. And the physical chemists at NIST and so on had measured the proton affinities of some of the amino acids, but most of the amino acids, but arginine is too basic for the reference compounds that were available and the methods that were available. So we used this method where you have the two molecules sharing a proton, and the one that's more basic leaves with the proton.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the international meeting in Amsterdam in whatever year that would have been. Probably 1991.
Mm-hmm.
And among other things, I met the Russian Victor. What is Victor's last name? Anyway, it was finally time that the Americans and Russians could talk to each other.
Yeah.
And Russ, we'll think of it in a minute.
Russ. Yeah.
But most important, more importantly, I saw a poster.
Rosprovich, Ross. Oh,
God. Anyway, I saw a poster that had a compound on with a proton affinity very carefully measured that was more basic than arginine. And so we actually could order the compound, came home, ordered it, did the charge competition experiment and published the. Now the physical chemists thought this wasn't the perfect method, but it's the only method.
Yeah.
It's the only value still in the literature.
Yeah.
So
it is a case where the poster session was very.
Tau Rosa.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure.
Okay. Where the poster session, or is that I stumbled into that poster session?
Yeah, that's, well, I mean, that's what the whole business with the idea information exchanges and in a conference, and you know, if one good idea comes out of it, then
yeah.
You know, that's I'm sure there are a lot of good ideas come out if you could go around and tote them all up. So that was a pretty cool kind of deal.
Yeah, that was an exciting time. Some of the other things we did, when we got electrospray, we could do a lot of things, and we looked at...
So that you didn't get electrospray until you moved to the UMBC?
Right. Well, no, is that true?
We had the thermospray back in,
I moved there in 88, it's probably, that was the first instrument I had it on, and it wasn't... Yeah, okay.
Yeah, well, electrospray didn't really get to be popular until...
90?
Late 80s, early
So
90.
I think that instrument was delivered with Fab, and then we used it that way for a couple of years, but we got the electrospray. And again, JUL did a very nice job of engineering it. Okay, so the other kinds of things... So I really did a lot of work with proteins, not yet proteomics, but protein studies at UMBC. And the arginine basicity was... part of what you needed to do to do peptide work, at least. We published an experiment which is not referenced much, but I believe is the first experiment using mass spectrometry to map protein folding, protein topography, and I did it with a physical chemist, and we used acetylation. Which is not like as subtle as HD exchange, but anyway, we published that paper in Analytical Biochemistry in 1991, and I think it's an important paper that people have missed or not referenced anyway. And I think it was the first paper that reported using mass spectrometry to study protein topography.
So what protein were you looking at? Some particular ones or just?
No, it was a binding. There. Have you got the title?
It's 19.
It's one of my Gross's favorite compounds, like proteins, actually. But he was interested for different. He was
we're doing 91?
Yeah, and the first paper might have been Murphy, but it's in Analytical Biochemistry.
First authors. For 91, first authors Bryant, Vinslau, Hua. Odell, Orlando, Rose.
No, that was not.
Shore, Simpson, Steiner, Unger, Westling.
Yeah, Steiner. That was it.
Steiner.
Okay.
Mass spectrometry method for the interface topography interacting proteins illustrated by a Millikan-Kalmodulin system.
Yeah, so we use the Millikan-Kalmodulin pair. You know, Kalmodulin rearranges itself when it binds Millikan. And about that same time, Mike Gross was interested in counting the calciums in And it turns out, you know, Kalmodulin had been heavily studied by the physical chemists in the preceding decade. But anyway, so that's what I'm proud of, even though it's not highly referenced.
So you were able to investigate folding?
The structure of the folded protein. Folding has a kinetic implication. We just looked at it after it bound small molecule, the peptide, and saw that it three-dimensional structure was different than when the small molecule wasn't bound.
Okay, and that how did you know that?
Because we alkylated it. We alkylated all the accessible lysines,
okay.
And the number of accessible lysines, and then denatured it and cleaved it with trypsin and looked at each peptide to see if it carried an acetylate acetyl group, and the number of lysines that were acetylated was different in the free calmodulin and the complex calmodulin, and we argued that when it was complex, the some of those lysine sites were protected.
Were protected in the the formation of the protein
complex
structure as a result of the wrapping around a calmodulin.
Mm-hmm. The calmodulin wrapping around the.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Got it backwards.
And that's the strategy that's now done with hydrogen deuterium exchange.
Yes.
And other alkylation reactions.
Yeah.
So I like that one, but I don't think a lot of people saw it. That was just before good Google indexing,
Yeah, well, it's analytical biochemistry.
And
so
that's not a,
Is that not a?
It's not a protein journal, but.
Yeah.
So, okay. And then I guess the other one I should mention from that time period is a collaboration with some folks from the Frederick Cancer Center, which was rapidly at that time turning into an HIV research center.
Mm.
And they brought us a gene product from HIV, which they had in culture and under appropriate safety conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted us to, it was known that there were 11 proteins or some given numbers, finite number in the virus, but that these all were cut out of just a much smaller number of long proteins that were the direct gene products. So we looked at the gene product and could say which of the proteins, the smaller proteins, were cut from it and where the cleavages occurred.
Okay.
And that one's actually very highly referenced. That's the Journal of Virology, 1992. And that particular gene product is called GAG. Don't ask me why.
GAG proteins of the highly replicative MN strain of human immunodeficiency virus type 1 post-translational modifications.
Has all those bad words in it.
Yes, Journal of Virology. So it's GAG, but it's not G capital A capital G. It's GAG, G little A little G. Is that
whatever the title says?
Well, they've got G little A little G here, but I'm not sure how.
I think they might use all caps, but I'm for a gene. But anyway, so that was we did, and then there was lots more, and with the superb capabilities of that system in electrospray, we looked at carbohydrates, and we did just a number of other things. It was a very productive period, and that was the period when I really started having graduate students.
So in this work, where you were doing a kind of a medium-sized down type approach, you were doing some digestion?
I think we probably did we weighed them, sure, but we did most of it, what we call bottom-up,
Okay, yeah.
But it wasn't really proteomics yet. It's the structure of several proteins, but proteomics is high throughput.
Yeah, that's a good, one of the things I was going to ask you, what is your definition of proteomics?
Okay, it's automated analysis, automated or high throughput analysis of complex protein mixtures.
Complex protein mixtures that are pertinent to a cell?
Well, the protein mixture can come from cells, it could come from a whole animal, you could grind up a spider or something. It could come from a subcellular organelle, you could just isolate nuclei and look at the proteins in the nuclei.
So it can be anything you want, but you're trying to find out about all the proteins that are in this.
At once. In one experiment. And maybe you never find out about all of them, but many of them, yeah.
You want to find out as many as you can.
In
a hurry.
So, that's high throughput. So people used to spend the whole PhD thesis purifying one protein, you know, and then hopefully they could have time to get it sequenced by the chemical methods that require a milligram of material, and with mostly we now still look at peptides, but by looking at the peptides and with the genome sequenced, so we have a collection of all of the possible protein sequences, we can characterize a peptide, look for it in the peptides from all of the genome, all across the genome, and perhaps know thereby what protein we're working with. And then you can ask more definitive questions like, what's the post-translational modification? But anyways, you can define your proteome as an animal, a cell, we could look at the heart, what is that, an organ, or a subcellular organelle like nucleus. And also, you have to define your proteome in time, because it's different for a young person and an old person, and it's different for a well person and a sick person. If you think about the monarch butterfly and the monarch caterpillar, same genome, different proteins, different form function. So time is a variable in defining the protein mixture too.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, then that's what is the big buzz thing in mass spec today is this proteomics.
It's tripled the attendance at ASMS.
Yeah, it's turned it into a biology meeting.
Full of European postdocs.
Yeah. And a lot of people I've never seen before.
Usually European postdocs. Yes.
So this JAO machine, when you put it on the ground, it started delivering results.
Yeah.
You didn't have to mess around.
Right.
And you got graduate students.
Well, but postdocs are still very productive. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, you really, you were starting to now really have
trained
graduate students, and which is something you didn't have that much of an opportunity to do.
In the medical school.
Now, the school that you were at, this in-between places school, was kind of small, wasn't it? I mean,
it still is. It has about 10,000 undergraduates and graduate students total.
Oh, okay.
It's a really difficult size because, it's not 2,000.
Yeah.
Where there's certain expectations, and it's not 20,000 where there's a lot more budget. But Freeman seems to be keeping it going.
And you had a pretty successful tenure there.
Yeah, I thought so. As the chair, I was able to double the size of the department space.
Okay.
My one disappointment was that I was never able to increase the number of the faculty, and they still haven't increased it. You know, I've been here 12 years, and UMBC still has the same number of chemistry faculty, so...
So how big was that group faculty when you
started? It was 18.
Okay.
Which is just under critical mass, most people think.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And obviously the department had a specialization or more of a flavor.
You have to teach everything. So we have to have physical chemists and inorganic chemists and organics and biochemists. So we had all that stuff.
Yeah, but like you say, with 18, it's not, you need a little bit... Is it not quite the critical mass to be able to make a big dent in any particular area? Is it
so to my surprise, the strength that developed there while I was chair was in NMR.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And maybe some people would say we had strength in mass spectrometry, too. But I hired a young man to teach inorganic chemistry, and he started looking at peptides, proteins that bind metals, and he started doing that by NMR, though I don't think that was in his background much. And he also he got a hold of them, had found the money to have synthesized a long peptide that was the model for one of the important HIV proteins, and showed the structure in NMR binding zinc ions, and that really launched his career. And now he's been a Howard Hughes fellow.
Oh boy.
You know, which is good support.
Oh, yeah.
And his name is Mike Summers. So that was another good thing that happened while I was there, and in addition to my own success.
Is that S-U or S-O?
I think it's S-U-M-M-E-R-S.
Okay. And were you the chair of the, during your whole time there? Or did
I was, you know, when I was the acting dean of the graduate school, I was not the chair. But I came back to it.
So what kind of issues did you have to deal with? I know when I was in the UK, and I think you're probably aware of this, is that a lot of the chemistry departments in the UK are being kind of...
Downsized.
Sized
out. Outsized.
Right-sized or wrong-sized.
Well, as I said, I was disappointed that we never could increase our faculty enrollment. The hardest issues for me were the tenure decisions. There were a couple split decisions, and you know, some that were where people were denied tenure, and that's always hard to tell someone. We had some good faculty, good researchers, good teachers there. I had a really good administrator who'd been one of my lab technicians at Hopkins, a woman named Sharon Morrell, she went over and managed a lot of the room assignment and, you know, counting the students in the class and that kind of work.
So when you have these issues with tenure, I mean, there was obviously some turnover in the faculty, I assume.
Could replace the ones that left.
And so generally speaking, what happens if there's like a period of a year or so after they're not granted
tenure?
After
they're told that they are not going to get tenure,
they have an opportunity to look for another job.
And several of the, maybe they went mostly to industry. This has been a pretty good area to work in because there's employers of many kinds. From this department, a number of people who haven't gotten tenure have gone to work as NIH program officers. We have to be very nice to them at all times.
That's maybe not such a nice place for them to be. Yes, I have some issues there, I can see. You go away and scary stuff. Yeah, that would be an interesting situation. Some of your previous students are now out there deciding whether you should be funded.
I'm sure this happens to the people. They have to work for somebody.
A lot of people don't like to deal with this department chair thing. They see it as kind of a super pain in the can. But you didn't. You saw it as some more of an opportunity to try and shape.
I wanted to try something else. Remember, I'd been in the medical school for a long time, so I wanted to, you know, be back in education and try some other, have some other career experiences. Somebody wrote that we should change our jobs in some way or another every 10 years, and so we can get a new instrument, but that's not quite as good as. I had the full support of the president and the very good assistant, my previous technician, so it was okay.
So did you get good references from Johns Hopkins when you left there? I mean, were you on good terms with the people there?
Oh, I have no idea if they ask anybody.
Oh, okay.